for West University Avenue at Urbana, offering complete car maintenance, scheduled maintenance, and repair service, including a nationwide warranty by ASE-certified technicians. Located near the U of I campus with shuttle service available. More information is available at 367-0300.
Good morning and welcome to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Freinas at the controls this morning. Well, if you were with us for the first hour of the show, you heard the conversation we had about the culture of the ancient Celtic world. Well, we are now about to take a big leap and jump right into the 21st century, because in this part of the program, we'll be talking about the growing interest in the web log, or blog for short, which is, if you're not familiar with the concept, something of a kind of an online journal that have, and these things have proliferated greatly over the last couple of years. It has become a very popular tool for personal expression. There are people who write in their blogs about politics. There are people who write about culture. There are people who just write about their daily lives, and it's there on the internet. They're posted and they're open, and they're the kind of things that anybody can read. They can sometimes make interesting reading and sometimes can indeed have a profound impact on politics and culture. In this part of Focus 580, we will be talking with the co-author of a recently published book that tries to look at the blog, the web log, and its significance. The title of the book is Blog: How the Newest Media Revolution is Changing Politics, Business, and Culture. This book is published by CDS Books, and the authors are David Klein and Dan Burstyn, and it is Dan Burstyn who is our guest here this morning. He's an award-winning journalist. He's a New York Times bestselling author. He's also a venture capitalist. He's been writing about new technology trends for more than 20 years. He's the founder and managing partner of the New York-based venture capital fund Millennium Technology Ventures, and over the last 10 years, he served on the boards of more than a dozen new technology and media companies. He's talking with us this morning by telephone, and questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line, so it means if it would be a long-distance call, you can use that number and we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. Let me also just mention one other book that Mr. Klein and Mr. Burstyn co-authored. That book came out back in 1995 and was titled Road Warriors: Dreams and Nightmares Along the Information Highway. This was one of the first books to take a close look at the impact of digital media on business and society. So you might want to take a look at that book. Certainly you can look for the new one in the bookstore, in the library. And questions here are welcome. 333-9455. And we also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. Mr. Burstyn, hello.
Hey,
thanks.
Pleasure to be here.
Thanks for talking. I hope now I was just told I was mispronouncing your name. I hope I got it right.
You've got it right now.
Burstyn. Okay. Burstyn. Well, thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it. I'm thinking about the fact that here on the program, and I'm trying now to remember when this was. I'm thinking it might have been early last year, but it might have been a little bit before that. In any case, we had a guest on the show who's been on off and on. He's an English professor here at the university, and we talked a little bit about language change, and we talk about grammar and so forth. And on this particular day, he used the term blog, and he used it a couple of times. And we had a call. We actually had someone call in, a caller who was listening, and they said, "What is this blog thing you're talking about?" So I'm thinking that even now there might be some people who are listening to us who have no idea what a blog is.
Well, it was speaking of your language professor, the most frequently looked up word of 2004, according to the Webster's people, and it won the Derby for first place, because in 2004, especially in the election campaign, people were hearing this word so much, and if you are not a leading edge internet person, and if you're not in the demographic of people sort of 14 to 24, it probably is not a part of your daily life even now. But of course, within what we call the blogosphere, a really ugly word that describes the world of blogs and bloggers and people who are talking to each other and posting on each other's blogs and listing each other's blogs on what are called blog rolls. In this world, this is a very smug, inner-directed world where it's a little bit, if our listeners have read the Harry Potter books, it's sort of like the wizards and the muggles. People who are inside the blogosphere think that the rest of the world doesn't exist. And if you've never heard of a blog, you're just hopeless. And meanwhile, three-quarters of the American population and a higher percentage of the world population is sitting on the outside of the blogosphere wondering what the heck this blogosphere is all about. To be really simple about it, blogs are personal websites typified, although there's no common agreement about this, with frequent short postings, almost like postcards or journal entries, that a blogger on a specific subject or an area of interest or a passion or an area of expertise or a general interest segment posts these ideas, these quick thoughts, these references to other people's blogs, comments about things they read today in the New York Times or in the local newspaper or saw on television, and then invites other people to post to their comments, and along the side lists blogs they like or blogs they think people should be looking at. And these things tend to be to have what are called hot links, where you can just click on them and go directly to that other blog that you're being referred to. Or if somebody mentions Time Magazine in a blog, in an article that appeared in Time Magazine, you click on the title of the article and you go right there to the article in Time Magazine, and so forth. So we have, prior to the rise of the blog, which the first blogs were in the late 1990s, we had about 10 million Americans who said in answer to surveys that they journaled every day. They wrote by hand in a personal journal of some type. And a great many of those people have emerged as bloggers, taking in many cases their very, very personal thoughts. And this is one of the really surprising things that sometimes we get a window into when there's a terrible tragedy that happens that involves a young person or a kidnapping or a murder or something of this type. The police go back and look at the young people's blogs and see them talking about dating situations and highly personal material. And for a certain generation of people, the blog has become similar to the kind of very personal diary or journal that one might keep in another era, except that it's open to the public. Mm. At the other end of the spectrum, we have major political bloggers, people like Daily Kos and Instapundit and so forth, emerging as really a major alternative source of news and ideas in the political sphere. Very, very influential in the 2004 election campaign, presidential election. I expect these people to be even more influential in 2008. The bloggers at the political and economic and business end of the world are making news, are creating stories, are causing the type of discussion we're having today, which would be considered part of the mainstream media because it's being broadcast over radio, causing the mainstream media to assign columnists and producers to monitor what's on the blogs, because that's often now a source of primary breaking news. So there's everything in between influencing presidential elections and talking about what happened on Johnny and Sue's date last night. And that's just a small look into the blogosphere.
Yeah. Before we started to see all these people blogging, there were a lot of people, well, I don't know if a lot is the appropriate term, there were people who had personal web pages. How is, in what way is the blog different from the personal web page?
In my view, I don't like to spend a lot of time on the semantic difference here. There are people who will try to give you a very exact definition of the difference between a personal web page in a blog or a website in a blog. It's really, the blog has come to mean certain things, although it doesn't technically mean those things. It means, as I said before, frequent short postings, sometimes daily, sometimes even hourly. It means generally opening up the mechanism, the software, so that other people can respond and comment and argue and debate and add their own thoughts. So it means a high level of interactivity. Previously, at people's personal websites, they were publishing their thoughts, but there was no expectation that other people were going to respond with their thoughts. With a blog, the expectation on most blogs is that they will be interactive. In fact, a number of CEOs of major corporations have started blogs thinking, hey, here's a great new PR tool, and I've got the megaphone, and I'm going to put a warm and fuzzy human face on my company. I'm the CEO. I'm going to talk on my blog about my fishing trip to Mexico, about our great human relations in promoting women and minorities to new positions, all these wonderful initiatives the company is doing. And several CEOs started to use a blog as a tool, but didn't think they wanted to make it interactive and didn't think they wanted feedback. And the blogosphere got very irritated with these people and said, you know, if you put up a blog, you better expect that you're also providing a forum for your critics and your interlocutors to say something back to you. Mm-hmm. So the authenticity of the voice that's in a blog and much of the popularity of those blogs that are the most popular has much, much to do with the voice, the tone, the attitude, the personality that gets expressed through the blog form. There's an expectation that I'll be able to argue with you if you're posting on a blog. And if you don't give me that freedom and that ability, I'm going to be extra critical of you. And I'm going to go on someone else's blog and denounce you for not providing me with that feedback channel. So there are many, many ingredients that go into it, and I think it'll evolve over time. And in fact, one of my primary ways of looking at all of this is to suggest that there's a growing convergence of the blogs and new media more broadly and traditional media. There's a convergence that the mainstream media people, if you look on any TV talk show now, on any cable channel, Chris Matthews, Sean Hannity, whoever it is, these people all have their own blogs now, so you can get even more of their opinion and ideas on blogs. A lot of top journalists working for major daily newspapers now have blogs where they can say much more than they can say in their daily newspaper article. So the mainstream media is itself emulating the blog approach. At the same time, although the blogs have correctly been criticized for frequently being irresponsible, even slanderous, libelous, attacking people's reputations with no evidence, not practicing basic standards of journalism, we're seeing that the better blogs, the more important blogs, are developing, if not explicit codes of conduct, then at least trying to mature in a direction similar to the direction that traditional journalism has gone in terms of filtering information, editing, not just being raw, unedited rumor and gossip and subconscious brain, but we're seeing the bloggers develop responsibility, code of conduct, ethics, principles that may be very personal. It may not be exactly what you would expect from the New York Times or the Washington Post or National Public Radio, but it works for them and for their audience. So I think we're seeing a great convergence of these media, and it'll become increasingly difficult to even ask the question that you asked, and I excuse myself for the long digression here. But websites, personal web pages, blogs, and even traditional media are all kind of melding into the new information-rich culture surrounding us.
We have a caller. We'll get right to them. Let me introduce again the guest, Dan Burstein. He's an award-winning journalist. He's New York Times bestselling author. He's also a venture capitalist and has been writing about new technology trends for more than 20 years now. He's the co-author, along with David Klein, of a recently published book entitled Blog, How the Newest Media Revolution is Changing Politics, Business, and Culture. CDS Books is the publisher. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. We have a caller here in Champaign County, here where we are, line number one.
Hello.
Yes.
There are two things I wanted to sort of bring up, and there, one of them is very specific and one of them is a little more general. The specific one is I was very preoccupied with the Alito hearings, and I found sort of these contemporaneous blogs where various scholars were, you know, putting up notes about the questions and the answers as they were being said. And that was quite an interesting phenomenon. I couldn't keep up with most of it anyway, but I mean, the idea of the blog is that you can then go back and look through it. One thing that I did in the process of that, there's a pretty well-known right-wing judicial blog called Power Lines, and they had a reference, which I found on Google, to Alito's answer to one about this Eisenstadt ruling, which is about the legality of contraceptives being sold to unmarried adults or something like that. The specifics aren't terribly important. Well, to some people, I guess it would be. But he said that he didn't agree. He agreed with the results, and that nobody asked him if he disagreed with the theory. But but it was interesting to note that the blog took that site down. So it was still in the files of Google as a clip, but it wasn't available in toto. Yeah. So I thought that they found that embarrassing. I don't know if you have anything to say on the contemporaneous blogging business. But the other thing is that there's so many things that people are tracking now with blogs. One example that struck me quite hard, this last 60 Minutes episode had a piece on global warming, where they complimented the Bush administration for spending so much money on studying it, and then they had somebody mildly saying, well, they don't seem to like the results. But there was no acknowledgement of something that you can find on many environmental blogs everywhere, which is this: two people have had to quit the Bush administration because they were caught, you know, boulderizing the reports. So it isn't so much that they were it isn't so important how much money they're spending. It's a matter of and not liking the results. They were actually caught altering the results, but there was no acknowledgement in that. And I'm sure that the blogosphere, I haven't actually checked in on it lately, but I'm sure there are a lot of people just going crazy on that kind of result. And it actually gives me a place to join in with some people. And
One of my favorite...
Thank you. I'm gonna hang up and listen.
Okay. Well, yeah, thanks for the call.
One of my favorite responses or indicators, leading indicators of what's happening in the blogosphere this month in February was an incident a couple of weeks ago similar to what the caller was referencing. You may have seen the story about the 24-year-old NASA public policy officer, Bush administration appointee, who seemed to be awfully young for the job, who had irritated a number of NASA scientists by requiring them to add the word theory to the expression Big Bang whenever the Big Bang was being discussed.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, he, a proponent of intelligent design who wanted to make sure that everyone understood that the Big Bang was only a theory and not scientifically proven. And it turned out that... that he had falsified his resume in terms of having stated that he had graduated from Texas A&M, I believe it was, when in fact he had only attended Texas A&M and not graduated. And this was exposed by a blogger, an American blogger, who is a Rhodes Scholar in Oxford and publishes a blog called thescienceactivist.com. And from his expose of this, the story got picked up in the New York Times, it got picked up in the Washington Post, and eventually this NASA official felt it necessary to resign as a result. So the story itself was broken on a blog. The blog ended up leading the news media to find the same, the mainstream news media, to find the same fact set. And interestingly, the blog itself, as the caller referenced, environmental blogs and so forth, you could never have a TV show or a newsletter sustainable devoted to some of these narrow focus areas, such as science activism, or I shouldn't say never. It's quite difficult to start, for example, a magazine devoted to science activism and incur all the cost of magazine publishing. Whereas one individual who happens to have a certain set of beliefs about how scientists should be concerned with political issues in the world can easily set up a blog and become one of the leading voices of science activism very quickly as a result of that. So we're seeing the rise of the citizen expert, and the great press critic A.J. Liebling said in the 20th century what was then true, which is freedom of the press is only extended to those who own one. But in the 21st century, the cost has come down so far so that when we have freedom of press, when we have free speech, and we use the new media and the blogs in particular, literally anybody can be heard, and anybody is being heard for good and for ill. So I find the blogs fascinating for their ability to get down to very micro niches of interest and yet build large communities of people who are interested in that specific niche. And this ranges from, I met a woman recently who was the blogger who does basically a daily blog on new cake decorating technology and techniques, to people who are covering the Supreme Court hearings in much greater detail with much greater expertise than the gavel-to-gavel coverage on television, with citations to cases, as the caller pointed out, with hot links so that you can go to those cases and see what happened in them. And the bloggers have been great at covering the Supreme Court hearings. But it's a niche. It's a handful of legal scholars and people concerned about checks and balances in our democracy who are very focused on these fine points of issues. And for that community, these blogs are very, very powerful communication tools.
Let's talk with someone else who is listening. We have a couple of others. Next person in line is Ann Urbana in line two.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah.
The democratization of information is interesting. I think in a way, though, that you need to sort of flip that and also say that also an educated and skeptical audience needs to be an equal participant because, you know, as you said earlier, there are so many viewpoints on subjects that how do you, unless you have at least the knowledge of the subject you're looking at, how would you know what's valid, what's invalid? You know what I mean?
Right. Mm-hmm. I've said that, you know, we have this expectation that we're living in the information age,
Yeah. But
we should understand that the information age also comprises the misinformation age and the disinformation age and the non-information age.
Yeah.
And we can't live without the information. I mean, I believe that the media writ large, which includes the bloggers but also includes traditional media, are integral to having a working democracy in a society as large and complex as ours. I mean, you or I can't possibly extend the scrutiny into the budget or into wiretap laws or into any particular issue that the original framers of the Constitution imagined the ordinary educated citizen would have an opinion about.
Mm-hmm.
We need the media to do its work. It is an unelected fourth branch of government. But within the world of people who are loosely called the media or who are publishing ideas, there are, you know, good people and bad people, well-intentioned people, people with integrity, people with political agendas, people with personal agendas, people who love and thrive on rumor and gossip, trade inside information in financial markets, et cetera, et cetera. So you're absolutely right. To educate ourselves and our young people to move into the society of the future, we all have to know and develop the tools to distinguish for ourselves accurate and inaccurate information, trusted sources, what comprises a trusted source. And that's, of course, a much more complex question than simply, who the most official source is, because frequently it's the muckrakers and the rebels and the outlying voices who actually have the most new and important to say. But how do you determine what an important outlying voice is and what an irresponsible outlying voice is? This is a new skill of the 21st century that we all need to develop our own standards for.
Yeah, I'd agree. I'm just wondering if there's a methodology that could be, like I used to teach years ago, and you have a methodology for a subject. I'm wondering if there's a way in which you could use example or counterexample skepticism. Some people are, just, I don't know if it's innate with some people it's not. They just sort of follow the line. But I really interesting subject. I'm looking forward to your book. Thank you.
All Thank right. you.
Thanks
yeah.
for the call.
An interesting thought there is and of course, humanists and technologists tend to have different opinions on this question, but there is a lot of very interesting software technology being developed associated with blogs and other new media tools to allow you as a internet browser and user to know in advance or to be able to qualify your reaction to various blog sources and almost to rate them the way people rate Amazon sellers or eBay sellers or Netflix films, and ultimately produce layers and layers of algorithms. And if they're done right, of course, the early generation of these things produced ridiculous conclusions. You went on Amazon and you bought a book for your kid, and the next time you went back to Amazon, it was serving you up a new children's title, assuming that that's what you were interested in. But the current generation and the future generation is much more sophisticated, and you will be able to tell that people who have your values and have your ideas found this blog to be worth your attention. And it will be getting closer and closer to performing those matches, understanding that intelligent human beings are quirky and random in their tastes and thoughts and values. But we're getting there, and I think that will be a piece of the puzzle in answer to the caller's question.
Very good. We will continue. We'll talk with someone else. This is an Urbana listener on line one. Hello.
Yeah, I was wondering if you'd talk about some of the basics, like does it cost much money to get going on a blog, and how do you break out and get some sort of attention? Apparently, there are millions of blogs now, and I guess I'll leave it at that. Thanks.
Yeah, there are an estimated 30 million blogs, maybe 40 million blogs now. They have been proliferating very rapidly. Within that, of course, a lot of people set up a blog and they do it once or twice and they never go back to it. So within that 40 million universe, there's probably 5 million blogs that have some real regularity to them. And within that universe, there's probably 10,000, 20,000 that are real working journalists, people of ideas, people with something to say, people who have a message they want to get out, people who follow certain subjects closely. I'd say there's maybe even 100,000 of those, what I would call quality blogs, where people are actually using the format for a discernible and important purpose and using it regularly and have a community of followers and posters and so forth. And then there's a service called Technorati, and there are a variety of these services, but at technorati.com you can see the top 100 blogs and how many hits they're getting and what they cover, and go to any of those and see what they're doing on those blogs. It's very low cost. Typically, even some of the major internet service providers like AOL will allow you to set up your blog and use their software at no cost. There are a couple of other systems, and Google does the same thing. There's TypePad, there's Blogspot, there's several services which are simply providing the software that allow you to post and to receive comments. And you'll find, as you look at blogs, that many of them tend to look quite similar because they're all, or many of them are organized around the same software templates. In order to keep the cost down. But, of course, you can get as fancy and clever and designed as you like, and you can upload all the graphics. And now, of course, people are going into video blogs and podcasting with audio sound and all the other derivatives of the blog. But the basic answer is it's cheap. What's hard is to get an audience. People work very hard at developing their audiences. Some people become overnight sensations because of something they discover or something they find or some allegation they make or some piece of gossip they have. And that's obviously a good way to get notoriety, and a lot of people go look at your blog. But the blog world is very, very fickle. Even someone who breaks a piece of salacious news about a celebrity on their blog, people will flock to that blog that day and the next day, and then if there isn't new information or interesting information, they go away very rapidly. People buy Google keywords and other search engine keywords in order to link to their blogs and attract people. And now we're just seeing the development of advertising models where advertisers are participating in networks to push their ads out to different kinds of blogs and actually creating a revenue stream. The first few years of blogging, the question was always, how can these people continue to do this, considering that it takes a fair amount of time and attention to be a serious blogger with no income? I mean, if people understand, if you write a book and you sell a book, you may not make a lot of money, but at least you get, you know, a certain amount of royalties. How can you be spending all this time blogging and no one is paying you anything? Well, now there are a bunch of services that are pushing advertising onto the blogs. It's causing controversy because some of the bloggers don't like that. And in some cases, services like AOL that are providing the blog software for free are also pushing ads onto those blogs. But in other cases, the bloggers are very happy because they're getting a revenue share and they're getting some income to sustain their efforts.
That's something that I definitely was in my mind as a question. That is that all along here, as the Internet has developed, people have looked at it and said to themselves and to each other, how do we make money on this? Is there a way we can make money on this? And that was definitely one of the things I was thinking about was, okay, now is there money to be made in the blogosphere?
I think there is. First of all, I think we'll see some of the blogs develop as basically the counterparts of major magazines and television shows and so forth, and they will have wide followings. And, of course, they're very low cost to produce, so those that adopt advertising or e-commerce models should be able to, as the saying goes in the business, monetize the eyeballs, meaning sell the audience to advertisers. And if you have millions of people reading your blog, you can be sure that the major advertisers or the niche advertisers, if you're doing an environmental blog, the Sierra Club may want to pay to advertise on your blog to attract new members. And that's one of the beauty of the narrow casting of these niches. The person who's doing the cake decorating blog may have a predominant share of all the people who are interested in cake decorating in the world reading her blog. That's a very good place to sell food coloring and cake decorating tools and chocolatier recipes and so forth. Mm-hmm. Businesses that would have liked to have advertised, but it's never been cost effective for them to do so in traditional media, now have the opportunity to reach very highly specified and defined audiences through the blogs.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Dan Burstein. He is an award-winning journalist, a New York Times bestselling author, and also a venture capitalist. He has been writing about new technology trends for more than 20 years. He's the founder and managing partner of the New York-based venture capital fund Millennium Technology Ventures, and over the last 10 years has served on the boards of more than a dozen new technology and media companies. He is the co-author, along with David Klein, of the book Blog, How the Newest Media Revolution is Changing Politics, Business, and Culture. It was published last fall by CDS Books. He and Mr. Klein also co-authored a book that came out back in 1995, one of the first to look at the broad impact of digital media on business and society. That book was Road Warriors, Dreams and Nightmares Along the Information Highway. We have another caller here, someone else, and others are welcome into the conversation. We have about 15 minutes left, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Caller here is in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. I just started. The timing is great here. I just started my own blog about a week ago. I'm using a free blog spot from Google or something. But my question is this. I stumbled across a discussion last night on the Internet. Some gentleman named Butterworth wrote somewhere that blogs are a passing fancy. Blogs aren't going to do anything to displace new media. They're not going to have much of an impact on the world. And I guess if you say there are only 10,000 serious blogs out there, let's say, and let's thinking that most of these bloggers just talk to each other more or less, they post on each other's sites, and it's kind of a small community in a lot of ways. I'm wondering what you would say about the impact of blogs outside of the small blogosphere. That's a relatively small number of hardcores. Look at the stuff they kind of agree with anyway, in terms of the impact of blogs on them, all on the larger media, and I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Thank you. First of all, none of us know for certain. I have a theory about the long-term impact of blogs, which is that blogs as such, that is, earlier in this conversation I talked about these short postings with responses from readers and so forth that we've come to recognize as what a blog is, that may be a passing fad, or it may just be one more element of our lives that doesn't end up making a huge difference. But a number of these bloggers are going to become major figures in the media. Even now, CNN has a whole hour of the day devoted to what's on the blogs. Other TV shows are constantly turning to the blogs for more information and for different sidelights on things. We know now that there was an Iraqi woman who was writing about the abuses in Abu Ghraib prison on her blog long before Americans heard the name Abu Ghraib. So the availability of the blogs, the ability of people to get their views out through this form, this is not going to go away. This is not a fad. This is a new way of carrying out important discussion in our society. But more importantly, the impact is going to be to continue to make all media more interactive, more 24/7, more local, more personal. And the impact that the blogs may have may not be so visible in the blogosphere as in how it shows up throughout the media and how it shows up throughout the public conversation. So that our very standards of what journalism is changing, because people have discovered that in the 21st century, the American audience, a very sophisticated, information-consuming audience, would like a little more personality put into the story. So we're seeing journalists in the mainstream media do things and say things and present themselves in a way that creates some of that personal touch that bloggers have with their audiences that wouldn't have been seen as acceptable 10 or 20 years ago. So there's a variety of ways in which the influences will be felt. In general, I think the biggest impact of the blogs will be the continued democratization of the media and the continued accessibility and ease of publishing. And it'll have huge effects in small niche areas. It's changing business. There are bloggers who are replacing research analysts covering companies because some blogger has decided to make themselves the expert on a certain technology or market segment or company where the investment banks have cut back, for budget reasons, their research coverage. So now if you want the definitive source of information on a certain company, you have to go to a blog, whereas previously you went to a research analyst at an investment bank. It's going to change many, many aspects of our lives.
I was thinking back to the beginning part of the program where we were talking a little bit, or you were talking a little bit about what exactly the blog is and how it is like or unlike earlier forms. And you talked about the fact that, for example, some people in their blogging are writing about their personal lives. And in a sense, it's like a journal or a diary, the kind of thing that in the past people would have done and locked up. It would have been their private thoughts intended for themselves and might be horrified at the idea that it would fall into someone else's hands and they would read them. And it's interesting that here now we would get to a point where someone would post that in a way so that anyone could read it. That together with the comment about what is happening, what seems to be happening now in broadcast news, both cable and over the air, that it does seem to be that we're emphasizing personality a little bit more and personal reaction to stories. This gets me to this whole question about why it is that it seems that we're now consumed with or very, very interested in people's intimate inner experience, and there are plenty of people who are willing to share that with anybody who's interested.
Yeah. And, of course, let me be very clear that when I look at the blogging phenomenon and the explosion of new media, this is not a one-dimensional vision. There are big problems and dangers here. The explosive growth in the last 12 months of MySpace, as just one example, which is a youth-oriented blogging system that Rupert Murdoch actually bought for News Corp, paid $500 million for in answer to one of the questions about where the money is going to be made. And now high schools and colleges around the country are dealing with these MySpace sites that were set up really to be internal to a given school or a given community. And young people are posting on these sites their sexual preferences, their dating habits, their personal likes and dislikes. And these things are actually quite open and porous for sexual predators and others to have access to. And people post pictures, and they post compromising pictures of themselves at parties. And we're finding that a number of new incidents of sex-related crimes derive from someone having lurked on a MySpace or another one of these system sites and then gone after a particular person that they were attracted to through this means. So this is by no means a world without its very serious problems. Now, the question you're raising is really a much more broad cultural issue of what is it about our complex, information-oriented, materialistic, technological society that causes us to want to assert our personalities in such bold ways that would have been considered impolite, inappropriate, or whatever one might say in another generation. And I think, to me, that is the answer, that our society, because of its materialism, because of its complexity, because of its grinding power on a daily basis to force people into certain acceptable behaviors in terms of work and family and daily life, some of the response to that is that people want to be more personal, and they want to assert their personality, and they use the very technology which sociologists might have argued would be alienating and depersonalizing, people sitting at a computer in their room late at night, to be the tool of asserting their personality and carrying out conversations with people all over the world and plugging in and connecting in various ways to our society and to our culture. And it's easy to sit back and say, oh, that's terrible. But, you know, studies are starting to show, there's actually studies that show that people who blog regularly find they need less psychotherapy, for example, because they are plugged into a community of people, because they're getting constant feedback from their peers, who may be people they've never actually met in person. But that human connection is made just the same. So I think it's a profound question you've raised, and it's would be the subject of a great book on its own.
Yeah. You make the argument that maybe the impulse to blog is something that predates the word and the technology. That is, the people were doing things kind of like this to the extent that, that technology permitted to do them some time ago. And that what happens here is the technology develops in it, and then it makes people, makes it more possible to do this thing, maybe to do it easier, to disseminate it, to do certain things with it. But that sort of fundamental desire to do that was always there.
Yes. I think that's true. I think what the blog is at its most basic level is an organized, structured, interactive conversation among lots of people. And I think when we think about what gives us our humanity, and people talk about man, the toolmaker, and so forth, one of the things that makes humans human is the desire to converse, to share experience, to share knowledge, to comment on each other's activities, to share wisdom. This is one of the reasons human beings were able to evolve, is because of the ability to share wisdom and institutionalize wisdom. So everybody didn't have to figure out for themselves how to make fire or how to make a wheel or how to make a tool. And in our day and age, we have so much wisdom to share, so that I go through in the book, and I point out, having gone to look recently at the cave art in the south of France, that I think there was an attempt to share and institutionalize knowledge through cave painting. And if you go through history, you see the example of the Talmud, and you know that the Torah wasn't enough. Jewish scholars felt they had to comment on the Torah and bring it up to date to their time period, and so the Talmud was created as a body of commentary on the Torah. And we go, you know, through the ages, and even there was a great tradition that I became aware of working on this book in America and in Europe in the 18th century, what were called commonplace books, where people actually kept in written form, not just a journal, but every time they saw a quote that they liked in a piece of literature or in a newspaper, they wrote it down in their journal, and they kept these little bits of wisdom. And then they would have actually meetings and group meetings where they would pass their commonplace books around, and other people would annotate them and add their own favorite ideas and quotations. Very much like blogs without the technology, with simple handwritten books. So I think this human desire to have the ongoing conversation and to share the insights and the gems and the ideas we find in our daily lives is powerful and is innate in the human mind.
We're almost out of time. Maybe I have about a minute. I guess one thing I'm interested in is, to the extent that you have talked to anybody about where the blog could go given, you know, the limits of one's imagination. When you come at a technology like this, one of the things I guess I find myself thinking is, okay, let's just make a leap. Maybe you can't do it, but if we could, if you'd say to somebody, okay, if we could do it, what would you like to do that you can't do now? Would you, for example, can you imagine something like where you would be able to actually tap into another person's experience in real time as they experience things?
Yes. I mean, you know, with the good and the bad. I appeared at a conference that was being blogged live while the people were speaking. And on the one hand, there were people who were able to raise questions from all over the world by putting them on the conference blog, and people who were able to point out errors in what speakers were saying or deepen what the speakers were saying with examples the speakers themselves didn't give. And then at the same time, I was shocked to read on the screen as the blog was going by the young, attractive woman sitting next to me was becoming the subject of blog comments from all over the world about how hot she was in a very high-minded conference on global economics. So, you know, we see both things, but it's already happening that the blog is being introduced into real time, into conferences, and many conferences today are held with simultaneous real-time blogs.
Yeah. We're going to have to stop. If folks who are listening want to read more, they can look at the book. It's titled Blog, How the Newest Media Revolution is Changing Politics, Business, and Culture by David Klein and our guest, Dan Burstein. It is published by CDS Books, came out last fall. Mr. Burstein, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Take care.
Programming here on AM 580 made possible in part by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois, on the web at AmericanClassifieds.com. Support also comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University in Champaign for over 15 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of name-brand foods from around the world. Your suggestions and requests are always welcome. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio. That's it for us on Focus. We want you to stay tuned, though. Much more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, a look at the challenges facing military families. Kristen Henderson will be our guest. She's a journalist and the author of While They're at War. That book profiles men and women on the home front in North Carolina in the Army whose spouses have been deployed in Iraq. That follows the 1 o'clock news this afternoon. Let's take a look now at what's happening as far as commodity prices go. Kansas March wheat is in fast track mode at 440 and a half, that up 5 and a quarter. Now to Chicago, the Chicago Board of Trade, where March wheat